good to have those conversations and check in on each other and hopefully encourage one another in those kind of things. So, all right, so we're going to go ahead and jump in. I apologize for my voice. I apologize if I have to blow my nose, which I guarantee I will, and we'll see how this may be shorter than usual, which expect that from Tony. I don't know if I expect that from you, Bill. All right, so this morning, just to kind of get us thinking a little bit about where we're going to look this morning, I think most of us at some point in time could say that we were lost, right? Whether you were following directions or, you know, the GPS or something like that, and all of a sudden you have no idea where you are, or maybe you got left behind for something or that kind of thing. If you're a parent or a grandparent, I think it's a rite of passage to leave one of your children somewhere at a supermarket or lose them amongst the clothes. My kids, for some reason, like to hide them when they were littler, a couple of the older ones, would hide amongst the clothes at, like, Walmart, and so you walk right past them and you couldn't see them and those kind of things, and so they would feel lost. I actually was pretty pleased with myself. There was only one time for a few minutes that I lost one of my children at the Mall of America this weekend. So I don't think he's too traumatized. I think he's all right. But I did all right. I felt pretty good about that at this point in time. But well, that's the thing. That's what I'm going to go. Thank you, Sharon. No, I appreciate that. There's another thought that I had or was reading through this. Back in the early 90s, I think this book was written. It's called The Face on the Milk Carton. And for people my age, kids my age, at that time, it was really popular. And it became, I think, a TV movie or something. But The Face on the Milk Carton, if you don't know what it's about, is basically it's this gal, I think her name's Janie, who, you know, back in the 90s, they had the pictures on the milk carton of missing kids and that kind of thing. And so she's looking at this milk carton. And she, you know, thinks of her life, and you kind of read the story of her life. She's got a pretty normal childhood. I don't remember how old she is, but things are pretty normal. She goes to school. She goes home. Not a lot of trauma or whatever. She lives with her grandparents, which is a little unusual, but for the most part, she's got a pretty normal childhood. Well, she sees this picture on this milk carton, and she starts to make connections and realizes that little girl's her. And so the rest of the story is about her, that is that face her and all these different kinds of things. And it's interesting. To me, that story is really interesting because Janie didn't know that she was lost. And like Sharon said, my son, he probably knew he was lost because he was the only one he was by himself in the mall with everybody else running around. So, you know, it's hard to know when you're lost sometimes, right? Lost is relative. So, you know, I also know a gal, and she posted something, this really unfortunate situation where she can't get a hold of her sister. Her family can't get a hold of her sister. And her sister's older, and I don't know, 30s probably or whatever, but she is purposely, I think, kind of gone off the grid. She purposely isn't contacting the family and different things like that. And so this family is, you know, distraught and upset about what's happening and where this sister is. But the sister knows exactly where she is, I think. You know, and so sometimes lost is relative. I know where I am, but I might be lost to somebody else. And so that's really, I think, what the story that we're looking at this morning is things aren't necessarily lost. They might be right where they're supposed to be. They just seem or appear to be lost. And so to kind of connect it all this morning, we're going to continue in our sermon series, God's Great Rescue Plan. We kind of took a hiatus last week, or at least I assume. I didn't get to listen to Neil's message, but we kind of took a hiatus last week. Since I was gone, and so we're going to get back into it and just start to see even more and more how God is doing this, as God is putting this plan into place and how that is unfolding, especially as we've been looking at the book of Luke, and we've seen how he uses this overarching plan, what scholars call the meta-narrative of the Bible, really the meta-narrative of history, and how God is using all of these different characters, people, individuals, stories, and situations to bring about his rescue plan, and how he's drawing people, and ultimately all of creation back to him. And so we've been walking through these stories. The last few weeks that I was here, we were looking at the book of Luke especially, and Luke does a great job of how he shows the transitions, of how we go from what we saw in the Old Testament and what happened to the people of Israel and what God is doing now and how God is stepping into the pages of history and doing something unique. And so, again, Luke does a good job of showing us metaphors and images to be able to reveal all of those things to us. All right, I need to pause. All right. I appreciate you guys being patient with me. So, again, looking at the book of Luke and the stories that we're going to look at this morning, we're actually going to look at kind of two different stories of how the transitions are happening here, but they kind of have the same background. They have the same context, the setting that they're in. And so I'm going to tie them together, and hopefully that makes sense for us this morning. But we're going to be in Luke chapter 2, starting in verse 22, and we're going to look, again, at the significance of the Old Testament and how God has worked throughout the Old Testament and the function and role that drastically change into what we see in the New Testament and what God is doing now. And so we start with verses 22. This is right after Jesus' birth and reveals to us how we kind of transition from Jesus' birth and the angels and the shepherds and all those things to kind of his ministry. This is kind of an in-between section here. It says verse 22. It says, and when the time came for the their purification, that's Mary and Jesus, I believe, came according to the law of Moses, they brought him up to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice, 24, according to what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. All right, so right away we see the setting. It says Jerusalem, they went up to Jerusalem, but ultimately they went up to the temple. This is the place where God's unique presence was supposed to reside. He was supposed to be in that place and reveal himself in a unique way. It's also the place in the center of worship and the center ultimately of sacrifice. And we see this setting revealing, again, an important aspect of Jesus' earthly parents, Mary and Joseph, because we see it, and multiple times we see how it talks about the law of the Lord or the law of Moses or some kind of law. It reveals to us Mary and Joseph were very pious, faithful, ultimately maybe just good Jews. They were doing what was expected of them. They were bringing the sacrifice, ultimately fairly poor person's sacrifice, but they were fulfilling the law according to what they understood and what they knew. And so that's an important aspect of who Mary and Joseph are and what kind of parents ultimately they're going to be as well. But we also see in the next section, if we kind of keep glancing ahead a little bit, we see two more individuals, two new characters by the name of Simeon and the name of Anna. Simeon seems to be just kind of a regular guy that gets kind of around the temple. He doesn't have a lot of significant things said about him. And Anna doesn't really either, but she's called a prophetess. And we don't know a lot about prophetess roles because there weren't a lot of them. Maybe it was just a female prophet at the time. We don't know a lot about what it exactly means. And I don't want to downplay these two individuals, but the next section really isn't about them. Simeon and Anna are basically representations. They're basically these two individuals that we can look to as part of what we maybe call the old regime. Excuse me again.
It's going to be a long morning, I think. Sorry.
Who knows? It might keep our attention better. I don't know if that's going to work or not. We'll see. All right, so Simeon and Anna. Simeon, we're not told how old he is, but we're told that he's about ready to die. He's ready to move on into the whatever afterlife. However, they didn't believe it quite like we do necessarily, but to be with God in some way. And so he's older, obviously, in some way. But Anna's mentioned that she's at least 84 years old. Some people have calculated that maybe she's over 100. And I'm just going to say this in their culture. I'm going to be very specific. In their culture, 84 itself is really old. And 105 is almost unrealistic as far as an age. Because their age, I think their life expectancy was somewhere closer to 50. Today, you know, being 105, that's wonderful and not as unusual. But these were individuals who were very old. That's purposeful about how they're written and who they are. But they're also both very unique individuals. I guess we'll talk about that in a minute. But just to think about their age and what they've been waiting for and the things that they're waiting for. But Luke especially, and God, I guess, through Luke and through the story, is revealing something to us. And we saw this when we looked at Luke 1 when we talked about Zechariah and Elizabeth, right? They were older. They were beyond childbearing years. But Zechariah and Elizabeth were blessed with a son named John, who became John the Baptist. And so this older generation, this older group of people, Zechariah, Elizabeth, Simeon, Anna, and all these individuals, are a revelation or an image or a picture of what was happening in the past. he's purposeful, and Luke and God are purposeful about showing us this is an old regime, and not to say it's bad or wrong or, you know, it's archaic and old and we need to get rid of it necessarily, but it's something different is coming. And that's what we see in these stories of Simeon and Anna, is that when Jesus comes, there's excitement and there's joy that something new, this new baby, is going to bring something new into this world. And so there's an age contrast being made here, and that's significant. Because we also, looking at Simeon and Anna, and I would say even Zachariah and Elizabeth, we get this image of what God expected and what God desired for Israel to be. We can see that they are pious people. They are faithful. Anna especially, not remarrying after she became a widow at a fairly young age, from what I understand. Not remarrying is a sign of her faithfulness to her husband, who has passed away. And several other factors. I think Simeon's called righteous. We get this picture of Simeon and Anna are the representation of Israel, or at least especially what God expected of Israel. But at the same time, it's the old, it's the past, it's the history. And so bringing this new baby, Jesus, into this temple and revealing him to, showing him to Simeon and Anna, shows us that they are ready for something new to come into this world. That they are excited, that there is an energy, and they are looking forward to what Jesus is going to accomplish. In fact, if we read Simeon's words, actually before I read them in just a second, both Simeon and Anna were waiting for something. It says Simeon in verse 25 was waiting for the consolation, or the comfort of Israel. He's waiting for the consolation, the comfort of Israel. Anna in verse 38 says, was waiting for the redemption of Israel, or the bringing back or the salvation. These two people are waiting for God to do something for the people of Israel. But more than that, again, what Simeon says in verse 29 through 32, it's more than that. And he says this, he says, Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace. According to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples. A light of revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people, Israel. And so just as the promises were given to Abraham that he would bless all nations, Simeon is reiterating that, saying, You have revealed this in front of everybody, presence of all peoples, and it's not only going to give glory to Israel and to bring them up and to lift them up, but it's also going to be this wonderful, beautiful light of revelation to anyone that's not a Jew, that's not from Israel's background, that is a Gentile ultimately. And so this tiny baby is going to bring all people ultimately together, or has the potential to bring all people together. And again, we look to the promises that God made to Abraham and what he planned from the very beginning. Simeon is saying, it is happening now. This is the baby that's going to accomplish it. And that's amazing to me that Simeon has that understanding, right? That's only something that God could provide. Because if we look at everyone else, almost everybody else in the New Testament, it seems like everybody else misses it or doesn't understand, or the expectations weren't met in some way. And so Simeon, in his revelation or whatever this is, if we want to call it a prophecy or whatever, tells us that this tiny baby is going to not only bring glory to Israel, but going to be a light for all other people as well. So we're going to jump ahead to the next story. We're going to take another break just a second. For Kleenex says, here I was thinking, and this is not a great illustration, but I kind of want people to time to see how long it takes me before I have a Kleenex, like a woman in labor, like in my contractions or something, but that's terrible. No, don't do that. Don't time me, please. That's all right, so jumping ahead to the next story in verse 41, we'll read that in just a second, but to kind of set the stage again, The background where Anna and Simeon are at was in the temple when Jesus was brought as an infant, as a baby. These two individuals see him and just have this wonderful connection with him and what he's going to be. Then we jump ahead several years, and we jump ahead to when Jesus is 12. And just like 84 or 105 is incredibly old for people at that time, the age 12 is also fairly old for that time period as well. So I've got a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. And you can't think of them when you think of Jesus in this story. They're wonderful kids, don't get me wrong, but they are not where Jesus would have been at this point in time, especially as far as responsibility and maturity and those kind of things, just because the culture is different, right? And just the expectation and those kind of things. And they're not here, so I can say whatever I want about them this morning. So, but again, 12 years old, that Jesus is, just imagine that he's probably closer to like an 18-year-old in our culture, if not a 21-year-old in our culture. Just the expectations and the responsibilities that they would be laid on. And when they're 13 years old, they're considered almost a full adult. And the responsibilities and what they're expected to do is pretty heavy on a 13-year-old in that culture. Okay, so keep that in mind as we read 41 through 51. So now his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. And when Jesus was 12 years old, they went up according to custom. And when the feast had ended, they were returning. The boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents did not know it. But supposing him among the group to be in the group, they went a day's journey. And then they began to search for him among their relatives and acquaintances. And when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem searching for him. And so after 3 days, they finally found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I have been searching for you in great distress." I think there's stronger words for 3 days of searching for a child, but great distress we'll go with. And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me?" Jesus says to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" And they did not, but they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. And Jesus went with them and came to Nazareth and was submissive to them. And his mother treasured up all these things in her heart. Right? When we read stories like this, it's so easy to put them in our own culture and our own context. And so something like this happening would just be completely outside of our realm of how did this happen, what happened, those kind of things. And then I thought of the movie Home Alone. And I thought, apparently, maybe we can understand it happening to a certain extent, right? You know, I could completely understand. Like I said, at the Mall of America, when I had all five of them, I kept looking back to make sure that there were all five following me going to where we were going and that kind of thing. And so I understand where you could easily, maybe at some point in time, misplace one of them, especially by the time Jesus is 12, Mary and Joseph could have, you know, five children too, or more. And so but again, at the same time, some of the things about this story aren't that unique, right? The fact that it took them a day to realize he was gone wouldn't have been that surprising because of the way they traveled and because of those kind of things. So they probably looked for him when they were setting up camp for the night and trying to figure out where he was. And so that part, they're not negligent parents that way. That's just, a 12-year-old you expect to be with the group and all those kinds of things. And so it's possible, this kind of a thing is possible. And again, the great distress that Mary says, is to be, you can say great distress, but then there's something you got to say that fits that a little bit better, I guess. But it's possible, I guess, as far as those things happening and how things fell. And in that culture and in that context, with thousands of pilgrims at that time going in and out of the city, having a large group of people that they're traveling with, it isn't that surprising to me that something like this could have happened. And maybe even happened fairly regularly at this point, in this culture at that time. But Mary and Joseph, again, we see them traveling a day, frantically returning, searching for a whole another day, finally finding him. And again, that worst, in great distress, like I said, that was probably the worst 2 days of searching for Jesus of their lives. This is my assumption, right? If I had to look for one of my children for 2 days, that would be, I might leash them, to me permanently at that point, right? So I never lose them again. And it would have been worse again in that culture where you have thieves and robbers pretty regularly on the paths, especially. They were far away from home at that time, a culture where they didn't have Amber Alerts, right? Didn't have cell phones, didn't have police that they could, point. The Mall of America, I kept hearing announcements, meet your party at this date, that kind of a thing that we didn't have. Jesus or Mary and Joseph wouldn't have had those things. But then they do finally find him, right? And he's fine. And Mary and Joseph probably aren't as fine, but they're found him. And we see this loving and caring nature of Jesus' parents at this moment too, and just their response to him and what they see. But Jesus' response, I think, is more important, because Mary and Joseph expressed their concern and their distress to what happened. But Jesus responds by saying, "Did you not know? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" And I thought a couple other translations were really helpful here. It says, another translation said, "Did you not know that I must be among my father's people?" And another one even said, "Did you not know that I must be about my father's business?" It's interesting. Jesus, like I said earlier, wasn't probably ever lost. Mary and Joseph thought he was lost. As a parent, you know, I would have, it would have been nice if Jesus had said, "You know, guys, I'm going to go into the temple for a while. Don't worry about me. I'll be okay. You can come back and get me after a while." You know, it would have been nice for a heads up as a parent, I'm sure. But Jesus wasn't ever really lost. He was exactly where he was supposed to be. So what did I just say? Jesus wasn't ever really lost. He was exactly where he was supposed to be. And again, this clearly shows something, several unique things, I think, about Jesus. First, he understands his purpose and his role, right? He knows where he's at. He also reveals to us that he calls God Father, right? At that time, that wasn't something that happened. Jesus was actually the one that instituted that for us. We call God Father all the time now, but in that culture at that time, Jesus was, or God wasn't considered Father. Right, and Jesus says, "This is who he is to me." And so he takes on this role, this mantle. It's actually a kind of a turning point in his story, because up until this point, and we don't have anything, obviously, or much of anything between his infancy and his birth and this story, but this seems to be the first time that Jesus takes the mantle on himself. You know, in the birth story, the angels show up and talk about who he is. The shepherds show up and are excited about him. Even Simeon and Anna, when he's a baby, are talking about what he is and who he's going to be. But this is the first time, it seems, that Jesus says, "This is who I am, and this is my purpose and mission in this world." And so he takes that mantle upon himself. It's going to be another 18 or so years before he steps into the role of what he's going to accomplish in this world. But he's understanding that he needs to be where he's supposed to be. And he's supposed to be and going to be about his father's business, about his father's people. And the next verse after that says that Mary and Joseph didn't understand that, which is understandable, right? We didn't understand it. Nobody around Jesus understood where he was, what he was about or what he was doing. Even after his death, even after his resurrection and he left up into heaven, they really didn't understand what was going on and what to expect. And so this is actually kind of the first time, too, where Jesus does something and expresses something that the people around him just don't understand and what's going to happen. And so we see that in this context. We see that in this story of who Jesus is and what he's going to do. And we see him start to step into that role. But we also see that as that story kind of winds down, we see Jesus saying, being submissive to his parents. And so if you've got, some of you probably had some great children. You probably had one great child and one other child. That's kind of how it works a lot of times, right? I don't know. I've got five wonderful children, so I can't say anything about that. But anyway, so I shouldn't think too hard about something like that. All right, so, but Jesus obviously would have been the model child, right? No matter what was going on and what was happening. And so the fact that the text specifically tells us that he was submissive to them is to me kind of astounding, because if you imagine God coming in and being a child, right? How amazing, or how much would you question your parenting, right? With my kids, especially as they get older, more and more I just tell them, just do it because I told you so, because I don't have a reason why I told them to do something sometimes. And I just make it up as I go along a lot of times. And so when they were younger, I said, do it because I said so, because I don't want to explain to the 3-year-old why they had to do this or that. Now the 13-year-old asked me and I said, I really don't know why, but just do it. Okay, I'm just making this up as I go along and we're just kind of covering my bases. You guys know. I know you know. You know what I'm talking about. But Jesus is one where, you can tell him to do something or tell, lay an expectation or have a thing that you're going to do in your family. And Jesus is, being the Son of God, he could be like, that doesn't make any sense. I'm going to do something different, right? Because he's God and he understands more, way more than we could possibly. But being submissive is amazing to me. You know, the fact that Jesus came as a person anyway, or God came in flesh anyway, is very submissive. But the fact that he was submissive to these young parents as well is, to me, just astounding. But at the same time, As wrong as, you know, maybe we as parents can be, as wrong as maybe Mary and Joseph were at times, Jesus obviously would have had the patience, had amazing grace and amazing patience, just like we see God having with us as well. And Jesus, as he grew, we see in verse 52 that Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man, right? Those around him, his, you know, his co-workers, right? If he was working carpentry and had people working with him, his parents, his siblings, his friends, his everyone around him was seeing how he was a good man, he was a righteous man, and he did what he was more than just what was expected of him, right? He had favor. And not only with man, but with God. And we kind of assume that he's going to have favor with God being his son, kind of a thing. But we see Jesus in this childhood role. He fit into, and I think we can assume he had a fairly normal childhood for the most part. But he was unique and he was distinct in that way as well, that he grew in wisdom and stature, just like I think all of us have and all our children do. But he also grew in favor with God and man. And so again, we see the transitions here. We see the transitions from what was done in the past, what God had done in the Old Testament, what is now what we consider old. And now God is transitioning into something new. And again, in terms of God's great rescue plan, this big story, when Jesus finally steps into the spotlight, revealing to us the purpose of all that God had planned from the very beginning, I just imagine this egg, right? This egg that's got the hard shell and maybe a mother bird sitting on top of it or whatever. And it's being incubated and it's being taken care of and all these kind of wonderful things. And that's the Old Testament. It's just being prepared. It's just being planned and put together, and everything's just right. And so at just the right time, at just the right moment, this egg can come forth, this healthy then baby bird can come out and accomplish what needs to be accomplished. And so the New Testament is the birth of that baby, and that's really this whole idea of this transition from the old, from the temple, like the setting was in this whole story, this temple, to what God is going to accomplish now into the future. And so the question is were the people ready, right? Looking at these stories of Jesus and interacting with the different people, were the people ready? I don't know. But probably a more pointed question for us this morning is are we ready? And there's a story I'd like to share. Just give me a second and I'll share it with you here. You know why I didn't want to shake hands this morning, right? No? So the story is several years ago, and I didn't double-check the date, but there was a story that there were these whales in the ocean that were stuck and caught in some ice. They were somehow imprisoned in this ice, and they weren't able then to swim to warmer waters. And, you know, we know whales are warm-blooded and need a certain amount of temperature, those kind of things. And as they struggled to get out and escape, people actually noticed their dilemma, and they risked their own lives by running out into the ice and trying to chainsaw and cut out the ice so that these whales could escape and get out into the warmer waters. And finally, then a Soviet icebreaker was able to come in and break up the ice so that these whales could get to where they needed to go and into safety. And that same year, there were some dolphins near Virginia Beach that were having some troubles, and there was something going on that they were dying. They were washing up on the shores of Virginia and Carolina. And people at that time started wearing T-shirts that said "Save the Dolphins." They had fundraising efforts. They took care of took businesses to pictures to businesses and executives, and they tried to raise money to find a reason why these dolphins were dying and what they could do and maybe discover a way to stop what was going on. And both of these are wonderful. We call them humanitarian. I don't know how humanitarian are, but I appreciate, right, sacrifice for animals and taking care of the world that God gave us and saving the dolphins and the whales and different other things. I'm all for that. I think that's part of our job and our responsibility as followers of Christ. But at the same time, sometimes my struggle is, and I the story that I found kind of was the same mentality is. We get so concerned about maybe, you know, risking our lives for saving these dolphins or risking our lives for saving the whales or raising money for saving the dolphins. But then we look around our world at people that are our neighbors, that are our, you know, coworkers, that are our bosses, maybe people that we don't really like, maybe very much even, but we look around us at the people all around us, and there are people that are just as stuck as the whales. There are people in our world that are just as lost and just as broken as the dolphins were. And so my question this morning for us, as we think about Jesus being lost, as we think about the frantic search of his parents, do we have that same concern and care for like Mary and Joseph had for their child? Do we have the same compassion and desire for bringing other people to know who Jesus is and what he's done for us? And I know I struggle with that at times. I struggle saying the words. I just want to kind of be friends and hang out and do different things. But there's so much more that we can do. There's so much more individually that we maybe should do. That especially as we go into this new year, as we go into 2020 and we look at what God has promised and offered to us and this rescue plan that he has us involved in as well. I just wonder if, you know, we're willing to give and to save and to work hard for those animals in our world, which we definitely should do. Are we willing to do similar things, if not more, for the people in our world that need to know who he is? Jesus' mission in Luke 19:10 was, "For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." And for me, I would say, and I'm not a big mantra fan or, you know, new resolution fan or anything, but maybe for 2020, as we complete and work it through our rest of our way through this rescue plan, maybe that should be where we focus our time as well, to seek and to save the lost. Let's pray. Gracious Father, we are so thankful that you have given us life, that you've brought us into a relationship with you, that you give us a future and a hope. And we just pray, Lord, that we have the mentality and the hope and the desire to do that for others around us as well. Help us to maybe even be a little obnoxious with our desire to share and to draw people in, to invite them into your community, into your churches, but especially being able to say the words of life and love that you give to us. And we pray this all in your Son, Jesus' name. Amen.